doing two more experiments. Again, this is another step where we're working with our partner. You will do one of the experiments, your partner will do the other, and then share the data amongst yourself. The two experiments we're going to be doing is a Fischer sterilization reaction and a dehydration reaction. So let's talk about the Fischer sterification reaction first. So an ester is just a derivative of a carboxylic acid. And there are lots of ways that you can produce an ester. Kind of the most straightforward approach is to start from the parent carboxylic acid and the parent alcohol. Now, when you do this approach, your nucleophile is the oxygen on the alcohol. Alcohol oxygens are okay nucleophiles. They're not the greatest, they're not the worst. They're kind of right there, you know, sort of in the middle. And our electrophile is the carbonyl carbon of the carboxylic acid. And these are terrible electrophiles. They're not the worst, but they're very, very close to the bottom. And so the problem you run into when you take this approach is that our nucleophile is not strong enough to react with our electrophile. So if we mix these two together and then just say react, nothing is going to happen. The activation energy is just way too high for this to happen without some sort of help. Now you can help these reactions along a couple of different ways. One is to simply supply the energy necessary to overcome the reaction. Heat it up, add light, whatever source of energy you choose, just supply it. And this does work in many cases. We will see an example next week when we do that experiment. But unfortunately, in this situation, it's not very feasible at this level of a teaching line. Okay, higher division levels, we can certainly do it, but not at this level. So if we can't just simply supply the energy necessary, the next approach is to lower the activation energy. Okay, so the first approach is to simply overcome it. The second approach is to lower it. Good Lord, that's just terrible. Much better. Okay. This is supposed to be, there we go.
So how do you lower the activation? Well, you make one or both of your reactants stronger. Okay, the reason why we have this high activation energy is because our nucleophile is not a strong enough nucleophile and our electrophile is a weak electrophile. So if we increase the strength of one or both of these, that in essence will lower the activation energy.
So let's first look at our nucleophile. Can we make the oxygen a better nucleophile? The answer to that is yes, if we convert it to the corresponding oxide.
These are very, very powerful nucleophiles. And in theory, they should be strong enough to react with that carbon to make an ester.
But this really isn't a feasible approach. And the reason for that is that if I write R O minus plus R prime and put a question mark there, what are you going to write down as the products of this reaction?
Any thoughts? Yes?
You're not going to get the formation of an alcohol, no.
Think basic slash acidic.
Can I just swap the verb value?
Yeah, you're going to be acid-based reaction.
Okay, correct. So the other side of being a very, very powerful nucleophile is that you're often also a very strong base. So you've got a strong base reacting with a carboxylic acid. You're simply going to get the acid-base reaction. We're right back to the alcohol. And now we have a carboxylate, which is an even worse electrophile than the carboxylic acid. Okay?
So although in theory this should work, in practice it's not, really feasible with a carboxylic acid. You have to probably take a different approach. Okay? So if we can't go the alcohol route, can we make the carboxylic acid a better electrophile?
And the answer to that is also yes. We can convert the alcohol or the carboxylic acid to a different derivative, like say an acyl chloride or an anhydride.
Both of these carbonyl carbons are exceptional electrophilic carbons, especially acyl chloride. Very, very good electrophile, and you also have a really, really, really good leading group in the chloride ion. So, using acyl chlorides and alcohols to make esters, very, very straightforward reaction. I did that multiple times as a graduate student, and I love doing those reactions.
There are some issues in terms of a teaching lab that make these derivatives a little bit more problematic. And that is because, first, you're limited to which acyl chlorides you can buy and which anhydride you can buy that the chemical companies will sell you. And especially with acyl chlorides, they're not particularly stable molecules. Okay? When you're a teaching lab, we like to buy molecules in bulk. And we like to buy them to last 3 years. It just really helps with our budget. If we buy something, 10 kilograms or whatever it happens to be, that'll last us for 5 years. We've got plenty of the stuff. We don't have to think about that for quite a while. Can't really do that with acyl chlorides. They will eventually break down because they will react with the water in the atmosphere, et cetera, and so forth. You can use them, but you are limited. And in the terms of esters in the teaching lab, the reason for it is that we don't go this route is because there is actually an even easier way to do that, and that is the Fischer approach. And the Fischer approach is to run the reaction under acidic conditions. So we add an acid to our carboxylic acid, and this also makes our carbonyl carbon a better electrophile. So how does it work? Well, when you add an acid to your carboxylic acid, the first step, we protonate that oxygen. Well, oxygen does not like positive charges. And so whenever oxygen becomes positively charged, it wants to get rid of that positive charge as quickly as possible. It can do this in one of two ways. One, it just reverses the reaction, kick the proton off, okay? And certainly that's going to happen quite a bit. The other way it can do it is to decrease that positive charge by gaining negative charge, and you can get that from the carbon. In other words, you draw even more electron density away from that carbon. And that makes that carbon now even more electrophilic. Okay? So by running this reaction under acidic conditions, we do make our carbon a much better electrophile. And now our alcohol can attack this carbon. So we end up with our first tetrahedral intermediate with carboxylic acid chemistry you got to get used to tetrahedral intermediates, or kind of get to the tetrahedral intermediate, and then you can go on.
Always remember, you're going to be forming one of those, okay?
So we form this tetrahedral intermediate. Now there are, in essence, two steps that result in a proton shift. We're going to shift the proton from this oxygen to this oxygen. So the first step in that is to, of course, lose the proton from that oxygen. That's what happens. Whoa, that's not there. And neither is that. Sorry about that, folks. I did not catch it. But yeah, it should not be there.
It's now just an R prime O, no positive charge.
Okay, so the next step is this oxygen acting as a nucleophile and picking up the proton. So again, what we've done is we've shifted the proton from here to here. Now, why is that necessary? Well, because now we have a good leaving group in a water molecule, okay? And so the next step is kicking off the water, which is exactly what we do. And we're basically now almost completely there. The last step is to simply lose the proton. And so that's how we can make an ester under acidic conditions. And this type of reaction is typically referred to as a Fischer esterification. It's named after the German chemist Emil Fischer. And Emil Fischer in early chemistry is one of those really big names. His name is over a whole bunch of things. He won the second Nobel Prize in chemistry in 1902. And his name is just claimed to come from a whole bunch of things. Of course, everybody's favorite is Fischer projections, but in any event, lots and lots of things named after him. This is just one of them. And there are problems when doing Fischer esterifications. It's not like, okay, we've solved it, don't really need to think about it anymore, just go. Just like every reaction we've talked about, paper chemistry is easy. In the beaker is typically hard because there are practical problems we have to deal with. And the Fischer esterification is no exception to this, okay? So there's basically three things that we have to worry about. The first is your proton source, okay? Not really a difficult problem, but again, certainly something that we need to deal with because you can't just use any old acid. And the reason for that is, what do you think in terms of base, that oxygen, where does it lie on the base scale?
If I said, hey, how good a base is a carboxylic acid, you would say, isn't this a mistake? Because carboxylic acids are acids. It's kind of the name. And the fact of the matter is, yeah, but it can act as a base as long as you have a really, really good acid. And that's why the most common acid chosen is sulfuric acid. The reason for this is it is a very, very strong acid. And on top of that, it is the most produced chemical in the world. Easy to get, very cheap, also does the job extremely well. Okay? So again, not really a problem that causes you too much trouble, but something you do have to think about.
And some Fischer esterifications actually even require a stronger acid, and there are stronger acids that you can use.
But this is by far the most commonly used in these types of reactions.
Okay. The second problem is kind of the really difficult problem. And I refer to it as the equilibrium problem. So if we look at the mechanism again, every step in the mechanism is an equilibrium. That means that the whole reaction
is in equilibrium. And let's do a little bit of equilibrium review.
So remember, with equilibriums, we can write down this wonderful equation. We talked about this last time. KEQ equals products over reactants. And with the Fischer esterification, there are two products. There's, of course, water, and there is your ester. And there are two reactants. You have your carboxylic acid, and you have your alcohol. Now, I know some of you might be thinking, well, why isn't sulfuric acid considered a reactant? Well, in this reaction, sulfuric acid is acting as a catalyst. So we start off with a proton at the beginning of the reaction, and we have a proton at the end of the reaction. Okay, so something you always have to watch out for when you're thinking about what are my products and reactants. If you start off with something and end up with something, that is not a reactant, that's something else, usually a catalyst. Okay, so just like when we did the stereochemistry experiment, bromine was a catalyst. It was our catalyst to convert dimethyl malate to dimethyl fumarate. It was not absorbed in the reaction at all. Okay? So, since it's an equilibrium expression, we do have answers to what our KEQs are. For your typical sterically unhindered carboxylic acids and your primary alcohols, the KEQ is roughly equal to 4. Now, one thing about equilibriums is that at equilibrium, initially, we have no idea what the concentration of your products are. There's only one thing we do know about them, and that is that they are equal to each other. Okay, so our water concentration is equal to our ester concentration, and math usually likes to assign these things as the letter X. And then you start off with a known concentration of your carboxylic acid and your your alcohol, because you simply know that. But at equilibrium, they are what you started with minus X, okay? Doesn't really matter what number you start off with. One is just as good as any other number. So we end up with this expression, which we then can then simplify as X squared over 1 minus X squared. Now, embarrassingly, for roughly 16 years of me teaching this lecture, I said, okay, hey, this is a quadratic equation, we can solve for X. And I would actually use the quadratic equation and go through a step by step. And then one time a student said, let's use the quadratic equation. He said, you don't have to. And I said, why? Because it's a shortcut. And that is, you can take the square root of both sides. And I was like, I forgot about that in math, okay? This is an example where it works. So you get 2 is equal to x over 1 minus x. And then that gives us x is equal to 2/3, or roughly 67%. Okay?
So for the past several weeks, I've been saying, hey, percent yield calculations, 65%, it's really good. This is not a good percentage. The reason for that is that this is not percent yield, this is expected yield. Remember, in our percent yield calculations, we have an expected yield of 100%. Here, our expected yield is 67%. In other words, we've cut it by a third, and we already know we've been having some small issues with our percent yield number, especially when you're doing, you know, microscale experiments. If we're cutting it by a third, we don't expect really good percent yields here. So we have to force shift this equilibrium to
to get it to 100%.
Now, of course, mathematics says we can't do that. We can never get 100%.
Because, as I have said multiple times, math gave up several centuries ago, that's millennia ago, when they say you can't divide by zero. They just quit. All right? And so, yes, we cannot get it to 100%, but we can get it
infinitely close, I guess is a good word to say. 99.9. How many 0.9 decimal places do you want to go up?
And we do that in a couple of ways. Remember, in an equilibrium, you can stress it from the reactant side or the product side.
Product side is you remove one of the products as it's being produced.
You're usually going to focus on water if you're doing a reaction with water, because there are multiple ways to remove water from a reaction. But in reality, it doesn't matter whichever product you remove,
that does it out. Okay? But unfortunately, this isn't always a viable option, especially for a teaching lab, because removing water in many cases is expensive or takes a very long time. Okay? So not always feasible. We do it occasionally, but again, not always possible.
So if you're not going to remove a product, then we have to come at it from the other side, the reactant side. The product side is real easy for usually everybody to kind of grasp. It's like, hey, we do the analogy. Cut a hole in the bucket, fill it full of water, it's going to drain out.
If we want to keep it full of water, you got to keep adding more and more water. It's kind of a real easy analogy to grasp why removing a product works. Not the same for excess reactant.
Because if we have a cookie recipe, this, by the way, is the only one that has come close that I have ever thought of.
It requires 2 cups of flour to make so many cookies. If you want to make more cookies, add 3 cups of flour without changing any of the other ingredients. Yes, you will get more cookies, but they're not going to taste as good. Okay?
So, again, the analogy kind of works, but it's a lot harder to grasp. And fortunately for us, the math actually makes it really easy to answer why it works. Okay? So let's go back to the very beginning, and we say 4 is equal to x squared over 1 minus x. And we're not going to keep both reactants the same this time. We're going to change one of them. In this example, we're going to double it. Now, this time we do have to use the quadratic equation to solve it, but mathematically, it becomes very simple why adding excess reactant works, okay? Because 4, regardless of what number system you use, is 4. It's a constant. It does not change. If we have made the bottom number, that's called what in a fraction? Denominator, yeah, we're doing math review now, okay?
So we've got a denominator that has increased, but 4 is still 4. So the only way a larger denominator can work, if you want 4 to remain 4, is x squared has to get bigger, okay? Well, x squared is wrong. So mathematically, it does make very simple sense as to why this works, all right?
So if we double one of the reactants, we get it to roughly 85%. And if we triple it, so 2x is 85, if we triple it, we're already over 90%. And so getting it to 99.9999
actually is not that difficult. You usually need to get somewhere in the neighborhood of about 10 to 1 or better. Okay, so
it doesn't matter which of the two reactants you add in excess. Practically speaking, you're going to pick the cheaper of the two, which in our case will be the alcohol. And
We have a problem now when we're talking about green chemistry. Okay, remember I said we're going to talk about this a little bit. Here's another example. One of the things we try to avoid is excess reactants, because by its very nature, that means it's excess, it is immediate, or is at the end going to be disposed of. So we want to cut down on waste. We do that by cutting down on reactant. Well, this is a case where we have to use excess reactant to get it to work, because there are problems that make it much more difficult to go the other route. So how do we deal with this in terms of a green chemistry? Well, we deal with this problem green chemistry-wise by getting more uses out of our excess alcohol. So we're going to use the alcohol not only as a reactant, we are also going to use it as a solvent. Okay? So by getting at least two uses out of that reactant, we mitigate that problem of, well, we have excess reactant, got to get rid of it. Well, all of our reactions have had solvents, and we have to get rid of those too. So we cut down on the total volume, but by getting the solvent use out of it as well, we basically negate having the excess reactant. Okay, so as I said, green chemistry, you're not always simply decreasing. Okay, you can attack it from multiple approaches to achieve the same goal. All right. So we are using excess alcohol to solve the second problem. Now the third problem is related to the second problem, which is no products at the beginning. What do I mean by this? I'm not talking about the ester. Because if you have the ester, you don't need to run the reaction to make the ester. I'm talking about the other products for water. So we talked about water in the two previous weeks, because water reacted with first a primary reagent and then it reacted with a reducing agent. Water was a real problem there. This is a slightly different issue with water, in that if we have any water present at the beginning of the reaction, we're artificially raising the numerator now, which cancels out the whole progress we made by adding excess alcohol. And so you just have to get rid of the largest sources of water in a reaction, which is almost always the solvent. And so our solvent, since it's going to be methanol, has to be 100% methanol. We can't use one of the cheaper grades that has some water in it, because it doesn't result in a better product. Okay, so we use 100% methanol here, or another way of saying it is anhydrous methanol. Okay, so same basic issues that we've been dealing with before, making sure there's no water in our solvent, so that it doesn't affect the reaction. In this case, it's just affecting the equilibrium. Okay, so again, as long as we take care of these, the reactions, like I said, very, very straightforward, very easy. So what reaction are we going to be doing? We are going to start with benzoic acid in the presence of methanol and sulfuric acid to make the ester methylbenzoate. Very easy reaction to do in and of itself, because you add the alcohol, you add the carboxylic acid, and then you add the sulfuric acid to your reaction flask. Make sure, of course, your stir bar is in there. And then we're going to run this reaction as a reflux. All right? Now, reflux, not reflex. Now, we talked about this before in the Grignard reaction, where we had a place in the adapter and then the condenser on the Y arm. At that point, we said you don't need to add the water tubes to it, because the
Ether condenses at a very low temperature, it doesn't require the water hoses to cause it to condense. Methanol, on the other hand, does. So we do need to hook up the water hoses here. Water goes in at the top, or in at the bottom, and out at the top. This way you can fill it up with very low pressure. Don't forget to add the hose clamps to it. And there is a 30-minute reflux, 30-minute reaction time. Don't start it until you start seeing the condensation of methanol. You turn the hot plate on, you turn the stir plate on, hook up the water hoses, turn the water on, and then when you see the methanol starting to condense, that's when you start your timer. And when the reaction is over, you simply then have to isolate your methyl benzoate, and you're going to do some product analysis. We are, of course, going to calculate a percent yield. Again, don't use the weigh boats. Use your little beaker as the weighing container. Tear it out, then add the methyl benzoate to it. And then we are also going to take an IR. And in the IR, we are going from a carboxylic acid to an ester. So there's two things that we're going to be looking for in the functional group region. First, the carbonyl peak from an ester and a carboxylic acid. They are different, so you should see a shift in the frequency of your carbonyl peak. And that frequency shift should occur in the ester frequency. Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing is, we are adding a methyl group to our product. And normally when we've had aromatic hydrogens, I've said the carbon-hydrogen stretch is way too small, okay? Not this time. We are talking about three aliphatic carbon-hydrogen stretches versus five aromatic hydrogen stretches. So in other words, we can actually see this one now. It's not going to be huge. It's going to be a very, very small. So in your carbon-hydrogen stretch range, you're going to see the typical aromatic bumps, and then you're going to see a little teeny-weeny peak pop up, and that's your methyl peak. Okay? So we're looking for the disappearance of the carboxylic acid carbonyl peak. We're looking for the disappearance of the carbonyl or the carboxylic acid OH peak from benzoic acid. And we're looking for the shift in the carbonyl to ester and the appearance of that small methyl carbon-hydrogen stretch. Okay. Oh, one more thing that I did forget to mention is that once you get to the point where the reaction is over, to remove the remaining alcohol, you set it up as a simple distillation, and the boiling point of methyl benzoate much, much higher than the boiling point of methanol. Okay, so set up your simple distillation and basically set it to the boiling point of methanol, so you already have to kind of tinker with it a little bit. But once you start seeing all your methanol boil off, keep washing it, and when you see that solution really slow down and kind of stop, then you can stop the simple distillation. Okay? So, not a difficult reaction to do. There is a big safety issue, which is that we are using concentrated sulfuric acid. Now, we've used concentrated hydrochloric acid. We use about 12.5 milliliters, and we said you really need to be careful with that. Concentrated sulfuric acid is kind of on a slightly different level. So hydrochloric acid really hurts. You don't want to get that on your skin. It really, really hurts. Sulfuric acid increases that, okay? And not only that, it's extremely destructive to everything else. If you get sulfuric acid on your clothes, you're going to have a hole. That's just going to happen, all right? So
again, this is one of those, everybody needs to pay attention to what they're doing. You don't want to bump into anybody carrying sulfuric acid, and certainly you don't want to be carrying some sulfuric acid and accidentally bump into somebody as well. Okay, so just beyond your awareness,
who's around me, what am I carrying, what are they potential carrying, etc. And of course,
if you even think you have a little sulfuric acid, and trust me, you'll know. It will be very, very obvious. Ask me how I know, all right? It's very obvious. It's like, yep, I got some sulfuric acid on me. Get it under the water, taste that. 15 minutes, all right? Now, we're wearing gloves, we're wearing a lab coat, we're wearing our safety goggles, so we typically don't have much to worry about in terms of exposure, but it can happen, all right? So just be careful with that.
Time-wise, it takes approximately 2.5 hours from start to finish, maybe a little bit longer. Good percent yields are about 65%. This is one of those situations where we're dealing with a liquid, so we see numbers as low as 30.
Because when you're dealing with liquids, it's really easy to lose a couple of drops, and that adds up very, very quickly.
All right, any questions with
the
fissure
sterification before we move on? Yes? On that procedure, it says that we're doing gas chromatography.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that. Sorry. GC. Thank you for reminding me. We are doing gas chromatography. Do the gas chromatography before you do the distillation. All right? And a lot of people are always asking, you know, what are the retention times that I need to worry about? You don't really need to worry about it. Your GC chromatogram is going to look something like this, where you have a huge peak and then a very, very tiny peak. This is your ether. This is your methyl benzoate.
As long as you only have those two peaks and it's kind of in that ratio of really big, really small, that second peak is your methyl benzoate.
One other thing, you're going to notice a different odor. Esters typically smell very well.
Okay, it's a, you know, personal preference issue, but the largest natural source of methyl benzoate is a snapdragon. So if you ever go to a forest and see a snapdragon, you take a whiff of it, and then you get that whole, cool, I made that in organic chemistry lab, okay? Or even better, give it to your mom and say, I made that in organic chemistry lab,
at least the smell, okay? All right, any other questions?